More than 150 worshippers are injured after Israeli forces attack Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque, Muslims' third holiest site in occupied Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance groups and the Palestinian Authority warn Israel about the consequences of its attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. And Russia warns of consequences if Finland and Sweden join the US-led NATO military alliance. Hello and welcome, everybody. Tensions are simmering in the occupied Palestinian territories during the fasting month of Ramadan. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. More than 150 Palestinians were injured and another 400 arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have condemned the attack. Hamas called it a vicious raid and pledged to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. The Islamic Jihad described the attack as a crime and said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. The Palestinian Authority reacted too, saying that aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. It warned that the Israeli attack is a dangerous... Israeli forces have intensified crackdown across the occupied West Bank, killing a dozen Palestinians since Sunday. Crackdown, series of deadly operations against Israelis. Earlier, we contacted political commentator Saad Nimr for his take on the current circumstances in the occupied Palestinian territories. He believes the conditions are ripe for another war between the Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We think that the Israeli are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war. We were expecting that. For the last few days that Israel are going to escalate the situation in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and especially in the second Friday of Ramadan, because it happened that it is the first day of the feast for the Jewish people. So it's quite clear for the international community they have to, to take their responsibility as an international community, especially in the United Nations, who had so many resolutions to prevent Israel of doing lots of things, but the Israelis are not complying with any of these resolutions. And after the Amnesty International report that Israel is an apartheid state, I think that now the international community should start taking action. It's not only to condemn or to feel not comfortable with what's going on in the Palestinian territories.
Russia has once again warned Sweden and Finland against their intention to join NATO.
The choice is up to the authorities of Sweden and Finland, but they should understand the consequences of such a step for our bilateral relations and for the architecture of European security as a whole.
Maria Zakharova said the potential membership of Sweden and Finland in NATO will not beef up their national security and enhance their international image. On Thursday, Moscow also warned there can be no more talk of a nuclear-free status for the Baltic if the two countries join the U.S.-led military alliance. Finland said this week it will decide whether to apply for NATO membership within weeks. Sweden is also mulling the matter. Russia stands strongly opposed to NATO's eastward expansion and views it as a security threat. It's the eighth week of the Ukraine war. Ukraine says five people have been killed in Russian airstrikes in the east. It says that nine others were injured in the strikes that hit Luhansk and Donetsk cities, both part of Donbass region. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Donbass is now Russia's main target. In other parts of Ukraine, local media have also reported Russian bombardments, including in the capital Kiev, but no casualties have been reported. On Friday, Russia said it had struck a factory near Kiev which made and repaired missiles. Moscow has pledged to increase strikes against the city in response to what it calls terrorist attacks on Russian territory. Russia also says it has taken full control of a steel plant in the besieged port city of Mariupol. The United Nations says more than 5 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of the Russian special military operation on the 24th of February. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees said over 4.7 million Ukrainian nationals had fled across the borders, and the UN's International Organization for Migration said nearly 215,000 third country nationals had also been forced to leave Ukraine. The figures come after Ukraine said last week that 9 humanitarian corridors had been agreed between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from the besieged eastern regions. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities don't allow men of military age to leave the country. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. In other news, CIA Director William Burns has accused China of being a silent partner in what he called Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Burns said China poses the greatest challenge to the U.S. intelligence agency that has ever faced. He added Chinese President Xi Jinping is a formidable competitor lacking in neither ambition nor capability. Burns made the comments during his first public speech as CIA director. He said it's more of a complicated and contested world in light of what he called an adversarial China and revisionist Russia. Ties have soured between the U.S. and China over the past several years as Beijing has stood up against what it sees as Washington's hegemony. The U.S. says that China is helping Russia evade Western sanctions imposed over Ukraine. However, Beijing denies that. Another unarmed black man has been killed by police in the United States. The latest episode is another reminder that there's no end in sight to the deep-rooted problem of police violence against African Americans.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem.
Well, the Michigan police killing of the unarmed black man has drawn condemnation from activists. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has called it horrifying, heartbreaking, and deeply frustrating. Activists are especially angry with senators who blocked legislation aimed at reforming policing in America.
The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021. But bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Arms trafficking at Italy's main sea dispatch points is ongoing in breach of international and Italian laws. Dockers have found U.S.-made tanks in the hold of a Saudi ship docked at the port of Genoa. Our correspondent Max Schuele has this report from Rome.
Italian ports have often been central to international arms trafficking over the past years. Cargos of weapons destined for war-torn countries have been intercepted in various seaports, including those of Livorno, Naples and Gioia Tauro. On Wednesday, dockers belonging to the autonomous port workers collective CALP found tanks in the hold of the Saudi Arabian ship Bahri Jeddah, which is moored in the Italy's northern port of Genoa. CALP dockers have taken photos of the weapons placed on board the ship and published them on the collective's website.
The ship carries weapons and ammunition. We spotted M1 Abrams tanks already armed, produced in the US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, CALP dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has honored a pledge made to NATO a few years ago, raising military spending from 1.4 to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civili, Rome.
France's second round runoff is on April the 24th, and the media is finally getting serious about comparing the two candidates' records and proposals. Analysts say that unrest in Ukraine may tip the scales in a toss-up race. Rami Mazzari reports from Paris.
The latest second-round polls in France continue to show that Emmanuel Macron's once comfortable lead has vanished to make the race a dead heat. The mainstream media's insistence on talking about Islamophobia and xenophobia has already produced near-record abstention, but the unrest in Ukraine has forced real issues back to the fore. First the Great Recession, then the Age of Austerity, then the Yellow Vest Civil War, then the coronavirus era, and now an era of Russian sanctions? Devoted Europhile Macron remains committed to a long-term blockade of Russia, which requires years of economic suffering for the average household. Analysts say that voters may prefer Le Pen's France-first insistence that any Russia sanctions not bankrupt French homes and businesses.
She's a nationalist, and she's protectionist in some way. She's also protective. She has understood that it was important to sound as someone that would be here to take care of electors. It's whether it's for good or bad, but a lot of French people want to feel that they have a protective hand in government.
Le Pen has also promised to pull out of NATO's command center to restore French independence. Macron is relying on a demonization campaign of the National Front, just like in 2017. When the number two reason people voted for Macron was to block them from coming to power. Back when he thought victory was assured, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65 this fall. That may cost him key older and left-wing votes. He's backtracking and saying that he's now willing to listen to the ideas and desires of voters. Do left-wing voters believe Macron's claims that he's now willing to govern by consensus? Does France view Le Pen differently after 5 years of Macronism? The winning candidate may be the one who proves that they have changed the most since the very different year of 2017. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Some U.S. Republicans are calling for Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor's impeachment because she's refusing to let them distort electoral districts to their advantage. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Sam Levine under the heading, "The U.S. Republican Judge Blocking Her Party from Rigging Electoral Districts." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. In one of the final acts in a 24-year political career, the Republican Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court is defying her party and refusing to let them distort electoral districts to their advantage, a move that has some fellow U.S. Republicans calling for her impeachment. Since January, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor has served as the decisive vote on three separate occasions blocking Ohio Republicans from enacting proposed state legislative maps. She also sided with Democrats to block an initial GOP proposal for congressional districts before going into effect in January. Those decisions have prompted chatter among Republicans about impeaching O'Connor, 70, who will leave the court after nearly two decades at the end of this year because she has reached the mandatory retirement age for judges in Ohio. O'Connor has a long independent streak. A decade ago, she joined a dissent from the Supreme Court upheld the state legislative districts drawn by Republicans. She would later say that the decision, "I broke away from the mold in some people's minds," adding, "Party affiliation should not, and people have to understand it should not, have anything to do with how a judge does their job." In 2018, she joined with the lone Democrat on the court to dissent from a ruling upholding that forced the closure of the last abortion clinic in Toledo. She has backed criminal justice and bail reform as other Ohio Republicans are pushing to make it harder for someone to be released on bond. She has called for less partisan influence in the way judges are elected in the state. In 2020, just before the presidential election, she blasted the state Republican Party for accusing a local judge for colluding with Democrats, saying the attack was disgraceful and deceitful. Paul Pfeiffer, a Republican who served on the Supreme Court with O'Connor from when she joined in 2003 until he retired in 2017, said, "She's no shrinking violet. She's got sharp elbows," adding, "No amount of public criticism is going to change her mind if she feels that she's right in the position she's taking." William O'Neill, a Democrat who served with O'Connor on the court from 2013 to 2019, said she was the justice he wound up voting with the most. They were the only two members of the court who dissented in 2018 in the Toledo Clinic case. He said she can be swayed to reasonable arguments, adding her legacy is already carved in stone. The stand is taking is consistent with her entire career. David Pepper, a former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, claimed she is also one of the most successful politicians in the history of Ohio. She has been elected 5 times statewide, none of which have been close. The then Ohio governor, Robert Taft, picked the former prosecutor to be his running mate in 1998 to add law enforcement experience to the ticket. Once she was elected lieutenant governor, she oversaw the state's Department of Public Safety, taking on a leading role after the suspicious 9/11 attack. She would travel overseas with troops being deployed from Ohio, even though that doesn't typically fall within the responsibilities of her role. Taft said in an interview, "She took the initiative to do that, and I would say it was above and beyond what she would have to do in her role," adding, "She was part of our team, but she was also her own person. She was an independent thinker. She was elected to the court in 2002 and became Chief Justice in 2010. Now O'Connor and the court are not backing down in their refusal to let Republicans in the state get away with one of the most brazen efforts to gerrymander electoral districts to their benefit. A new provision in the Ohio Constitution requires partisan makeup of the state's 132 legislative districts roughly reflect the partisan breakdown of statewide elections over the last decade, which is 54% Republican and 46% Democrat. However, the three plans Republicans have passed so far, and a fourth one currently pending before the court, would enable Republicans to win a veto proof majority in the legislature in a favorable year for the party. Jen Miller, the executive director of the Ohio chapter of the League of Women Voters, which is involved in suits challenging the plan, said the constitutional violations of the maps that the Ohio Redistributing Commission continues to pass are obvious. Republicans have forced a sneaky attempt to enact their maps. The initial plan the court struck down in January would have given them control of 64.4% of districts. They then submitted a new plan to the court that nominally had required 54-46 split, but several of the districts were barely majority Democratic, essentially toss-ups, meaning Republicans could still win them in a favorable election. After the court rejected that plan, Republicans came back with a third plan that has likely increased the Democratic majority in those districts, which was again rejected by the court. Last month, Republicans submitted a fourth plan that took the same approach. Paul Beck, a retired political science professor at The Ohio State University, said, "It's a pure power play," adding, "It's almost like they're saying we have the power to do this, and so we're gonna do it." O'Connor has bluntly called out the way Ohio Republicans are abusing the redistricting process. The first time the court struck down the legislative maps back in January, she went out of her way to write a concurring opinion urging Ohio voters to strip lawmakers of their redistricting power entirely. She wrote, "Having now seen firsthand that the current Ohio Redistricting Commission, comprised of statewide elected officials and partisan legislators, is seemingly unwilling to put aside partisan concerns as directed by the people's votes, Ohioans may opt to pursue further constitutional amendment to replace the current commission with a truly independent, nonpartisan commission that more effectively distances the redistricting process from partisan politics. The standoff has left Ohio at a chaotic impasse. Unlike Supreme Court in other states like Virginia that have stepped in to draw maps, the Ohio Supreme Court is prohibited from making its own plan. Early voting began on April 5th without the state legislative districts on the ballot. Last month, a coalition of civic action groups challenged the maps to request that the redistricting commission be held in contempt for failing to comply with the court's orders." The hard line from O'Connor and three other Democrats on the Supreme Court, where Republicans have a 4-3 majority, is extremely consequential. This is the first redistricting cycle the partisan fairness requirements are in effect. Voters approved them overwhelmingly through a ballot measure in 2015. By refusing to accept the Republican maps, O'Connor and the court are setting a precedent that signals how aggressively the justices are going to police partisan gerrymandering.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the basic level of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, according to one of the classifications by some of our ulama of akhlaq, there are three levels explained for someone who keeps fast. The first one is the basic level. The second one is the moral level. The third one is the spiritual level. So let's talk about the basic level first, and then inshallah, if Allah gives us the tawfiq, we continue going through these different levels. The basic level of fasting is the fasting of the stomach. Stomach here is a symbol for physical desires of all types, food, drink, or sexual desires. This is a level where the person refrains from things mentioned in the list of muftirat, as we call them. Things that are forbidden while fasting, things that invalidate the fast, let's put it this way. By maintaining this level of fasting, people fulfill the duty of observing the fast and protect themselves from the hellfire. That's all you get at the end of this type of fasting. It will simply compensate for the wajib upon a Muslim's neck. So this is that bare minimum, bare bones, right? The least you have to do being a Muslim in the holy month of Ramadan. And it's just the basic level, right? While you should know that you have the opportunity to go to the higher levels, which, of course, is going to be much more rewarding, and we're going to discuss that. But know the jurisdiction of this basic level. The premise of this basic level is only abiding by those things which have been made haram upon you and those things that have been made wajib upon you. So you have to carry out the wajibat and you have to refrain from those muharramat, which are the forbidden things. And this is the bare minimum of fasting as prescribed by Islam, which every Muslim has to do except for those exemptions which have come in the books of jurisprudence. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the three levels of fasting, and out of them we have decided to discuss the basic level of fasting. As you all know that there are three levels of fasting according to one classification: the basic level, the moral level, and the spiritual level. So the basic level of fasting is what we're discussing today. This is the level which has been described in the famous hadith as, "Many are those for whom fasting was nothing but hunger and thirst." What does that mean? Think about it. Physically, one can be in the state of fasting, but spiritually, he may not have anything to do with fasting. Now, this is bad. This is horrible, right? While you fulfill the zahiri and the apparent requirements of fasting, in essence and in spirit, you're still not fasting. Now, how can that be possible, you may be thinking, right? Well, you're not eating, you're not drinking, you're not having sexual activities, and you're not, you know, doing any haram acts that invalidate the fasting. At the same time, you are not careful in lying and backbiting and cheating other people. So essentially, you have killed the spirit of fasting while you are physically fasting. Staying hungry and thirsty to comply with the requirements of Islam is good. But what's better is that a person tries to do more than just staying hungry and thirsty. And that's what Islam has required us to do. You know, something beyond staying hungry and thirsty and just doing the wajibat and not performing the acts that invalidate fasting. Now, what are those additional things that we are referring to is what we're going to talk about in future. But know that this basic level of fasting is something that does not take you too far in your spiritual journey. We leave you in the care and protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we will speak about the rest of the types in future. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. With US President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape in the United States looks grim for the Democratic Party. We now present you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Wave of U.S. House Democratic Retirement Stokes Fear for Party's Election Prospects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. For the Michigan Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, it was a question from her husband. When is our time? For the North Carolina Congressman David Price, it was a judgment that the time has come to step down. Some retiring U.S. Democrats have blamed the gridlock and dysfunction on Capitol Hill, while others point to the redrawing of congressional maps. Still others cite the rise of political extremism and the deteriorating relations between members of Congress, particularly in the wake of 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Announcing his decision to retire last year, the Wisconsin congressman, Ron Kind, was frank. The truth is, I've run out of gas, he said. The decision not to seek re-election is both deeply personal and political. But as the party braces for a grueling midterm election this November, a rising number of House Democrats are opting not to return to Congress next year. The Florida Congressman Ted Deutch announced that he would not seek re-election, bringing the total number of Democratic departures from the House of Representatives so far this cycle to 31. Among them, 8 Democrats are seeking other offices next year, like Tim Ryan of Ohio, who's running for the Senate, and Karen Bass of California, who's running to be mayor of Los Angeles. Some retiring members are powerful veterans, such as Kentucky's John Yarmuth, chair of the Budget Committee, and Oregon's Peter DeFazio, chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Others represent politically competitive districts, like Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona. It's a worrying trend for Democrats. Congressional retirements are often an early sign of a wave election for the other party. In 2018, dozens of House Republicans did not seek re-election, including the then House Majority Leader Paul Ryan. The Republican Party lost 41 seats that year, and Democrats gained control of the chamber in an election cycle widely viewed as a referendum on Donald Trump. This year, the political winds are reversed. Republicans are trumpeting each retirement as a sign that Democrats' hopes of keeping their majority are fading. The National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC spokesman Mike Berg, said their majority is doomed. Either retire or lose. Though many vacancies are in safely Democratic districts, the rush of retirements among Democrats comes as the party faces significant historical headwinds. The president's party almost always loses seats in the midterm elections, and in the House of Representatives, Democrats can only afford to lose a handful of seats before surrendering control of the House. With Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and rising inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape looks grim for the Democratic Party. Adding to the uncertainty is a once-in-a-decade redistricting process when a state's congressional and legislative districts are redrawn. The House of Representatives is often a reflection of the national American mood, which public opinion shows is pessimistic. Voters are frustrated with their political leaders, and the Democratic Party is bracing for a backlash. In polling that asked voters which party they would support on Election Day as opposed to which congressional candidate, Republicans repeatedly hold the edge. In an interview, Price, an 81-year-old, said his decision to leave Congress after 3 decades was mainly personal and not circumstantial. During the Trump years, he said many long-serving Democrats postponed the decision to retire because they believed their experience was needed on Capitol Hill. Now they feel the time is right to retire. Price's new district is rated safely Democratic, and after a long redistricting battle, the North Carolina State Supreme Court recently approved congressional maps that are favorable to the Democratic Party. Kyle Condick, the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said, "The number of retirements is naturally higher in years that end in 2 because those are redistricting cycles." It's been a brutal experience for some. Congressman Jim Cooper witnessed his reliable Democratic Nashville seat being carved up into 3 different districts that Donald Trump would have easily won in 2020. He decried the move as raw politics, and an effort to dilute the electoral power of black voters. A day after the Tennessee legislature approved the map, Congressman Jim Cooper announced his retirement from Congress, where he had served for more than three decades. He said, "I explored every possible way, including lawsuits, to stop the gerrymandering and to win one of the three new congressional districts that now divide Nashville." He added, "There's no way, at least for me in this election cycle, but there may be a path for other worthy candidates." John Rogers, a Republican pollster who was the executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee during the 2018 midterm election cycle, says the retirements of powerful and long-serving Democrats is a strong sign that the Democratic Party is bracing for defeat this November. John Rogers added, "There are too many committee chairs retiring for this to be just about redistricting," adding that the prospect of losing a gavel or ending a lengthy career in the minority was unattractive to some politicians. Retirements deprive a party of the advantages that come with incumbency: fundraising, name recognition, and a deep understanding of their constituency, factors that are especially critical in competitive seats. Kondik, author of The Long Red Thread, How Democratic Dominance Gave Way to Republican Advantage in U.S. House Elections, said, "Incumbency is not as valuable as it used to be, but open seats are generally harder to defend, particularly in a wave-style environment." Not since 1992 have so many House Democrats opted not to seek re-election. And with states still finalizing their congressional maps and candidate filing deadlines approaching, there might be more retirements to come. Kondik said, "However bad it is to serve in Congress, it's worse to serve in the minority, particularly in the House." Notably bucking the trend, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced her decision to run again, extinguishing speculation that she would retire at the end of the term. Nancy Pelosi was re-elected as Speaker of the House after agreeing to step down from the role by the end of 2022. The Republican retirements, though far fewer, are also telling. As of this week, 15 House Republicans have said they won't run for re-election, with 7 running for another office. Among them are more moderate members, including Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and John Katko of New York, who have faced conservative backlash for voting to impeach former President Donald Trump. Democrats argue that much could change before the November elections. The COVID-19 pandemic appears to be in retreat, and officials claim the economy remains strong despite inflation. Joe Biden has started to ramp up his travel around the country, touting his legislative accomplishments. He has received rare bipartisan praise from his handling of the crisis in Ukraine, and Democratic voters are excited about his nominee for the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is poised to become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court bench after a confirmation hearings later this month. And Republicans, they say, will have to answer for Donald Trump's enduring control over their party and the fallout from the congressional investigation into the events of 6th of January 2021, as well as for their efforts to restrict access to abortion and the ballot, issues that Democrats believe will rally voters to their side this cycle. Ian Russell, a Democratic strategist and former national political director with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, "Most midterm elections, by their nature, are referenda on a party of power." But he said that by embracing Donald Trump's lies about election fraud and refusing to sanction their most extreme members, Republicans are helping frame the election as a choice between two parties with very different priorities. only one of which is going to wind up in charge. Last month, Lawrence, the Michigan congresswoman, surprised some of her colleagues when she announced that she would retire at the end of the term, after more than 3 decades in public service. She said in an interview, after 4 years of Donald Trump's administration, the COVID-19 pandemic, 6th of January, it was a death by a million cuts. Lawrence, who represents a heavily Democratic district and is the only black member of Michigan's congressional delegation, said she feels good about her legacy and would continue to be active in her community in other ways. "I'm not going home to plant flowers," she said. She hopes her departure will make room for a new generation of black lawmakers who will bring fresh urgency to the battles over women's reproductive rights, voting protections, and police reform. She said, "I came into Congress when we were in the minority, but I came in with the intent to make a difference, and I hope that continues to motivate American citizens to step up into public service, because there is work to do."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
And every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble and beautiful tradition which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding affliction. To be more specific, this is about the worst of afflictions. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following to a man who was experiencing intense grief at the loss of his son. A person's son had passed away, and this person was experiencing very intense grief. He was very sad about this. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following to him when he saw him grieving for his son. The Imam said, "You are grieving at the minor affliction, and you are heedless of the major affliction." Meaning, so this is something very minor in comparison to another problem, which is far greater than what you have experienced. In continuation, the Imam said, "If only you prepare yourself for the place that your son has passed away to." Meaning, your son has passed away, he's gone into the afterlife, he's begun his journey into the other world. You should prepare yourself for your entrance into that world. If you're not prepared for that world, that's more problematic than the problem you're experiencing right now. The Imam then said, "Your grief would not be so intense for your affliction at having neglected preparation for it is much greater than the loss of your son." Meaning, the Imam was trying to say that, you know, you're experiencing this intense pain is indicative of the fact that you are heedless of the hereafter. A person who's remembering the hereafter and the affliction and the problems and the dangers of the other world, he would consider this problem and this affliction that he has that has occurred for him as being something very small. And that's why whenever we are struck with an affliction, we are told to remember the famous verse of the Holy Quran, which you are all aware of, "Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un." In the Holy Quran, we read, "We will surely test you with a measure of fear and hunger and loss of wealth, lives and crops, and give good news to the patient. Those who, when an affliction visits them, say, 'Indeed, we belong to Allah, and to Him do we return.'" This is one of the reasons why we, you know, remember this verse at this time, is to remind ourselves of, you know, the afflictions and the problems and the dangers that we might face in the hereafter, and in comparison to which the problems of this world that we all undergo seem trivial and insignificant, and this verse helps us bear the problems that we undergo in this world. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the greatest of afflictions and the way to counter afflictions in the beautiful words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The dead bodies that were scattered.